Welcome to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, September 8th, 2014. Scott Burton in the studio today. Joan Pardis will be with us on Wednesday. Dale Brandenburger will be here to tell us about his new novel, Grizzly Trade. Christina Bruce and longtime guide Marie Darlin will be on the show to tell us about what's going on at the City Museum and about the museum's historical walks. And as part of our CBJ Department Profile Series, we'll hear from Library Director Robert Barr. Plus, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. Stay tuned now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, there's some relief for groups, including First Nations, who are fighting a proposed oil pipeline from Alberta to the West Coast. The head of the Northern Gateway Pipeline says the $7.9 billion project won't likely start in 2018, as the company had hoped. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
John Carruthers, the president of the Northern Gateway Pipeline, is putting the best face on it, saying he's not that focused on an exact startup date, but what's important is that he gets everyone on board the project. That means the pipeline is being delayed again. Carruthers says he's working on winning the support of several First Nations who are still opposed to the pipeline.
We have stated that the earliest in-service date was 2018. That's quickly evaporating because we need to have this time to meet with people. So the focus will be on that re-engagement and not the in-service date.
Nearly 30 First Nations groups along the route of the proposed pipeline have signed deals with Enbridge, the company behind the project. They will take a 10% stake in the project. But there are still many other First Nations along the route who are fiercely opposed to the pipeline. They have refused to accept any deal and have threatened lawsuits which could tie up the project in court for years. Enbridge has already received regulatory approval for the pipeline, but is also working through more than 200 conditions imposed along with that approval. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The mayor of the city of Fairbanks, Alaska, is calling for federal review of long-questioned murder convictions of some Alaska Native men. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the mayor joins numerous leaders and groups pressing for review of the Fairbanks 4 case.
City of Fairbanks Mayor John Eberhardt was asked by the Tanana Chiefs Conference to join voices calling for the review. Eberhardt, a former TCC attorney, says he agreed for numerous reasons, including a 2011 confession statement from a prison inmate who's not one of the four convicted of the 1997 killing of 15-year-old John Hartman.
Unfortunately, that wasn't fully followed up with, and that statement seemed to contain information as to the possibility of some other people being the perpetrators.
Eberhardt also agreed to discuss a TCC request for independent review of Fairbanks police handling of the case. A hearing on the confession and other new evidence in the Fairbanks 4 case is pending in state court. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Officials with the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, which is landless, say another step has been taken in efforts to build a casino in Massachusetts. The tribe announced Friday that the U.S. Department of Interior has published the final environmental impact statement on the tribe's land into trust application. It includes a proposal for a resort casino and parcels for a government complex. The tribe is proposing to build a casino and hotel in the city of Taunton and says it will create jobs and boost the economy. The land requested in Mashpee will host a government center and provide services like education, health, and housing. A 24-year-old woman from Oak Springs, Arizona, was crowned Miss Navajo Nation over the weekend. McKeon Dempsey was one of six contestants who vied for the title last week. The competition included butchering sheep and bread making and contemporary and traditional skills. In her bio, she said if selected as Miss Navajo, she would focus on language resiliency and use the Navajo teachings to engage youth through language, culture, and art. As an ambassador, she would also like to contribute to the mental, physical, and social well-being of Navajo people. The Miss Navajo Nation competition takes place during the tribe's fair. A citizen from the Cherokee Nation has been appointed to the Oklahoma Advisory Council on Indian Education. The Cherokee Nation announced Friday that tribal counselor David Walkingstick was named to the 18-member council by the state's governor. He currently chairs the tribe's education committee and serves as a federal programs director. Walkingstick is an advocate for Native language and culture immersion in schools. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Supported by the National Indian Education Association, an inclusive Native organization representing Native students, educators, families, communities, and tribes. Membership registration available at NIEA.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. It's about 6 minutes after the hour here on Monday, September 8th, 2014. With me in the studio now is Dale Brandenberger, and he has with him his new novel, Grizzly Trade. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. You've been busy this last weekend, haven't you?
I have been. I've been doing readings and signings and interviews, and it's been really fun and getting a lot of support from the community.
Oh, good. Let's talk more about that in a minute. In the meantime, let's hear a little piece from your novel, Grizzly Trade.
Okay, well, I'll start right at the beginning. Alcoot, Alaska, 1992. A week had passed since Red found the corpse behind his cabin and called the state trooper. He didn't have a phone in his dilapidated shack. He had to drive 5 miles down a rutted dirt road to use the payphone that hung on the wall outside the ferry terminal. Red knew what it was straight off. Murder for profit, plain and simple. A large caliber bullet had pierced the brown bear's skull just below her right ear, ricocheted off some bone, and exited from the left side of her neck. A precise incision, probably made with a razor-sharp hunting knife, slit the bear's hide, and the gallbladder had been removed. All 4 paws had been hacked off with a bone saw, leaving the flesh ragged, the bone splintered. The coagulated blood was crusty, the color of burgundy wine, and crawling with black flies. Driving to the payphone, wedged behind the wheel of his tiny Datsun pickup truck, Red scratched at his curly red beard and wondered how much a bear gallbladder and a set of paws fetched on the aphrodisiac market in China. 7 long days had passed, and he was still having trouble getting the grisly image of the carcass out of his head. Crouching in the shadows beneath a huge spruce tree, listening intently as the breeze whispered lightly through the branches close to his head, he gazed out at the gray beach. A tendril of mist swirled ghost-like over the water. He smelled the spruce buds and heard the water gently lapping at the shore. Red tried to see, hear, and smell everything around him, and at the same time, hoping that by focusing his attention on every detail, he'd stop thinking about the mutilated bear. He slung his rifle over his shoulder, leaned into a spruce branch until it snapped, then cranked it back and forth, wrestling it from the trunk of the tree. He used the bow like a broom as he walked backwards across the beach, lightly sweeping his footprints from the sand. When he reached the water's edge, he hopped onto a log and swept away the last set of tracks. Anyone who hiked down this rugged stretch of coast would not see where he had entered the forest. Better safe than sorry. It was bad enough that the state trooper had come to his cabin. Although he was smart enough never to leave anything incriminating at his cabin, he didn't like cops in general, and that cop in particular. He scampered along the log, surprisingly nimble for a large man in his 40s. Living in the Alaska forest for the past 20 years had kept him strong and agile. The back of Red's neck began to tingle. He looked over his shoulder and scanned the beach once more, but it was just a breeze beginning to blow from the southeast, not the tingling sensation he had when he thought he was being watched. The bruised sky threatened rain, and darkness was falling fast. He jumped from the log onto a large granite rock, still trying his best not to leave prints in the sand. When Red's parole officer, a sincere but annoying do-gooder, heard about the poaching incident, he was afraid Red would go renegade. Referring several times to Red's anger management issues, he'd given Red a book on Zen Buddhism and suggested he take up meditation. Red promised he would give it a try, and surprisingly, he found the book interesting. He just spent 2 days at his secret camp, sitting on the edge of a cliff, counting his breaths and contemplating his navel with his third eye. He traversed the next stretch of coast, a series of tidal pools dotted with small boulders, and tried to practice being present by repeating his mantra, "Now, now, now," as he leaped from rock to rock to rock. But his mind kept flashing on the image of the dead bear. He felt the blood rush to his head. How do you not think? If I try not to think, then I'm thinking about not thinking. This is bullshit. Those Zen monks are a bunch of liars claiming their minds are like polished mirrors. Those guys are thinking about women and rice wine just like every other Tom, Dick, and Harry Carey. He kicked the mussel off a rock and sent it skittering across the water. If a monk ever asks me what's the sound of one hand clapping, I'm going to smack him right in the face. That'll get him thinking. I wasted 2 days sitting around. Maybe I should have tracked down those poachers. Purple veins pulsed on his neck and his pale skin flushed crimson as he thought once again about the dead bear. Balancing on one foot, he punted another mussel into the sea, lost his balance, and crumpled onto the rock he'd been perched on. Red rolled off the boulder into the tidal pool and gripped his scraped elbow, cursing. Frigid water soaked his jeans as he sat up in the shallow tidal pool. He gasped, stood up, and peered into the trees, making sure no one had seen him tumble off the rock. Then Red began to laugh wildly. "Now I know the sound of one hand clapping." Red heard his sopping wool socks squish inside his boots as he stepped out of the pool. He bent and picked a stalk of oyster leaf at the edge of the water. He chewed on it as he gazed out beyond the inlet at the snow-capped mountains, jagged like broken teeth. The oyster leaf, pungent and briny, tasted like the sea. He felt the first drops of rain falling on his face. "The monks say all life is an illusion, but who could dream a dream this beautiful? Certainly not a soaking wet nitwit like me." He thought about gathering some mussels from the tide pool, but he was already shivering and the last gray light of day was fading to black. He hurried down the beach, smiling at his own buffoonery. When he was almost to the road, he saw tracks where a brown bear had meandered along the water's edge. The tracks were different than black bear tracks, the toes closer together and in a straight line. The breeze still tickled the back of his neck. Red figured the bear had got wind of him and was long gone. Still, he pulled his rifle off his shoulder, chambered around, and switched on the safety. He had a great respect for bears. He followed the tracks until they veered off into the forest. Then he saw the boot prints and scarlet beads of blood in the sand. No, not again. He slung the rifle over his shoulder, pulled a flashlight from his jacket pocket, and charged into the gloomy underbrush. A few minutes later, he found the dead bear, blood still draining onto the forest floor where the paws had been sawed off. Red dropped a flashlight, raised his arms, and pulled at his hair. All the anger and anguish of a lifetime boiled up inside him. He howled into the darkness. Red had an anger management issue.
All right. Dale Brandenberger reading there from Grizzly Trade. Thank you for sharing that with us. So I have to admit I only got through the first chapter. But among the things that I appreciated about it were these thorough characterizations. And we just learned a little bit about Red, the protagonist there. And then we hear about, Tim, the journalist, right?
Yeah. Small town reporter.
Yeah. Tommy Tompkins and Tito Halfpint.
Yep. Those are the part of the criminal element who are working and selling these bear parts on the Asian aphrodisiac market.
And what's the trooper's name again?
Trooper Jake, they call him. It's short for Trooper Jacobson.
So, some great characterizations. You're a fisheries biologist by day, but a novelist by night. I imagine it must have been some of your experiences working throughout Alaska that gave you the idea for some of these characters?
Yes, a lot of these situations that are in the novel are right out of actual events that have happened. There's a cruise ship spill where they're dumping photochemicals and dry cleaning chemicals is part of the plot as well. And that is an incident that happened in Haines back in the 90s. And the bear poaching actually goes on. I talked to the troopers a lot about that. It's more prevalent than I had realized.
Wow. Interesting stuff. So, fisheries biologist by day, novelist by night. What's your writing process like? How, in fact, with this book, how long did it take you to produce?
It took me about 3 winters to write it. I couldn't do it in the summer. I'm usually working 6 or 7 days a week in the summer. It's my busy time, and I'm out working long days in the woods. And so the winter is a good time for writing. So I worked on it each winter for 3 winters.
And do you have a background in writing?
I do. I started writing when I was 10 or 11 years old, doing comic books, that sort of thing. Then went on to writing bad poetry, and then I was the editor of my high school paper, and then I went to University of Maryland, started as an English major, then changed to journalism. Then I got out of school, and I wanted to be a novelist, but I didn't have anything to write about because I was in my 20s and had never did anything but live in the suburbs. So then I moved to Alaska and started working for Fish and Game, and then I went back and got my biology degree.
Got it. So among the themes in this book, one of the ones that I noticed the most is the poaching one. I think that's what the book revolves around for the most part. Is that true?
That's correct.
What about that bothers you? What inspired you to write about that particularly?
Well, anytime I love animals, I always have, and anytime animals are killed for, and there's wanton waste involved, and for businessmen to, you know, make themselves more potent at the annual convention, I just thought that was a shame. And I love bears. I love watching them. I've enjoyed them over the years, and I just hate to see them get killed for something as menial as that.
I hear you. And let's talk a little bit about Red, your main character in this book. Was there somebody specifically that you've met in Alaska? Or is he an amalgam of different characters? He seems like a character himself.
Well, everybody who's read the book has really enjoyed the character of Red. He's a Vietnam vet, and he has an anger management problem. Those of you who know me at Fish and Game know of our buddy Red, who is from Ketchikan, who is a big burly guy with a red beard. And the physical characteristics are based on Red because I thought it would be a good image. You know, it's something the readers could visualize easily, a
sure.
big burly guy with a red beard. And although the incidents themselves did not actually happen to Red, and he's not a Vietnam vet, and this is not his story. So, and I took a few different people and characters and put them together to make Red. Yeah.
What was the most challenging part of the whole process, putting this together for you?
Well, the most challenging part of the process is probably just bringing yourself to the table every day to write.
Mm-hmm.
People often think, oh, you know, that guy's talented. You probably know this from being a musician. People just, oh, you're so talented. You're so good. And they don't realize all the hours and hours of practice and hard work you put into it. And writing's part talent, but it's also a craft that you have to develop. So you can't sit around and wait for inspiration. You just got to sit at the desk every day and say, okay, I'm going to sit here for this many hours and see what happens. And I'm not going to leave till then. And sometimes days when you feel uninspired and you don't think you have anything to say, that's sometimes, you know, inspiration does happen. So,
sure. So true. Ernestine Hayes, great writer here in Juneau, once told me, or told my writing class, you know, the muse is never going to come find you.
Yeah, you know, that's a good saying.
The muse is not going to find you. You need to go find the muse at your keyboard or wherever it is you do your writing, whether it be longhand or... Okay, so that was the most challenging part, was getting yourself to the table. What was the most fulfilling part of this process for you?
The most fulfilling part is probably finishing the book. You know, I wrote another book that wasn't very good, and it was kind of depressing, and I didn't incorporate humor into it. And part of the reason I wrote this book and in this style, I've read tons of Alaskan books over the years, and there are generally two kinds. There's the folksy sort of nature writing or homesteader type, and then there's people rehashing the old Jack London, man trying to survive, man striving against nature. And those are good. I ate those up. But when I look around Southeast, and I've been here for a long time, I don't see people striving to survive. I see people thriving. And I see all these Alaskans with great senses of humor and great stories to tell and having adventures with their lives. And I wanted to put that into the book, so I hope that comes across, and that's probably the most fulfilling part.
Great, and I like what you said about humor. There's definitely some humorous lines that had me laughing out loud as I was reading. It seems like an essential part of most literature.
Yeah, and, you know, it has serious parts, of course, because it revolves around the killing of these animals, but it has some good eccentric characters and a lot of humor in it. Hopefully people have as much fun reading it as I did writing it.
Oh, good. And speaking of reading it and how to get the book, let's see, you were real busy last weekend, right, doing signings. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did a reading over at Old Harbor Books in Sitka. They're carrying it as our bookstores in Petersburg and Ketchikan. And then I did signings for First Friday at Hearthside Books downtown, and the Valley Store as well is carrying the book. And Saturday I did signings at Rainy Retreat Books. And all the bookstore owners have been great and very helpful in letting me come and do that. And so support your local independently owned bookstore and go on down there.
Absolutely. It's called Grizzly Trade. And any more events here in Juneau in the near future? You're going up to Haines, right?
I'm going up to Haines to read at the library on Thursday and then on the Skagway. And then I think in the spring I'm going to do some readings out at the Glacier.
Okay. Well, Dale Brandenburger in his new novel, Grizzly Trade. Dale, anything else you'd like to add?
No, I can't think of anything else except enjoy this beautiful sunny day, and I hope everyone enjoys the book.
Yeah, Hearthside and Rainy Retreat. Dale, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Take two old pistols and hold up. Be sure to tune in on Saturdays to KTLO to hear some new shows on the air. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has moved to 10 a.m., and at 11, we're now bringing you NPR's latest hit, the TED Radio Hour. At 2 p.m., catch the hot news show, Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Information on the changes are at ktoo.org.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 8th, 2014. Scott Burton in the studio with you today for Joan Pardis. She'll be back on Wednesday. And now in the studio is Christina Bruce. Welcome, Christina.
Hi, Scott.
And Marie Darlin.
Yep.
Welcome. Oh, let me get your mic on there. Welcome to the studio today.
Thank you.
I love your last name.
Good one.
It's a good one. So, Christina Bruce, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on at the City Museum right now?
Well, right now we're finishing up with our summer season, and we'll be in summer hours through September 24th, which is the last cruise ship day. Our summer hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 6, and Saturday, 10 to 4:30. And through September 30th, our prices are $6 for adults, $5 for seniors, and kids 12 and under are always free.
Okay.
Coming up this month, we have on September 13th is the Day of Play, which is in conjunction with Parks and Rec. So all the Parks and Rec facilities plus the City Museum are having a period of free time for anybody who wants to come in. And at the museum, our free time begins at, I believe, 11, and it runs for, I think, an hour and a half. And we'll have a scavenger hunt for kids to play and some other museum activities. And it's during that time, it's free for everyone to come on in.
Sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else going on you want to share?
We have a fabulous little gift shop, and for the month of September, we are having a 25% sale off of just about everything in the store. There are a couple other items that are even deeper discounted, and there are lots of really fun little toys for kids. We've got some beautiful prints, art cards, some very unique historical medallions, and we've got lots and lots of books for the history buff. So there's plenty to see. Maybe get a little early Christmas shopping in.
Yeah, absolutely. Never too early to think about the holidays. All right. Thanks, Christina.
Mm-hmm.
And Marie Darlin, you have, among other things, been leading historical walks. I know you also have worked on the Empty Chair Project. Which one do you want to start by telling us about?
Well, let's just start with the empty chair, because we can do that fairly quickly. That actually started, and our exhibit at the City Museum started actually when we opened up this spring. And it was on an exhibit put together to show the Japanese internment during World War II, which many people have never even heard about. Some are well-versed in it, particularly those from the West Coast who were also involved. And this was where, after Pearl Harbor, all Japanese were then looked at possible suspects for whatever they wanted to consider. And so they were then interned into camps, which were back in from the coast. The people from Juneau who were interned actually went to Minidoka in Idaho. Some of the ones that mostly the fathers of the families who were actually taken to jail the day after Pearl Harbor, the families followed later in April. But anyway, it was a case of something that we hope never happens again. And there were certain things that went on because of that, that we then built a memorial chair, let's say, around. And the chair idea is from the fact that in 1942, one of our Japanese families, their oldest son, was to graduate as valedictorian of his class. And our superintendent decided that they would be leaving, being shipped out by the end of April, all the families, and therefore John Tanaka or Tanaka could not be here for the May graduation. Mm. So therefore, he had a special assembly called at which John was presented his commencement certificate and everything. And then at the May commencement exercises, there was an empty chair for John.
Oh.
And that's where the empty chair idea came from. I happened to be in the class of 43, so I was there and am one of some of the, there are still a few around town who might have been around at that time, but not in school. So therefore, we built the project around that. And it's his sisters who, after they came back after the war and finished school here and all, decided that because where they were, there were recognitions given to the actual internments and all, that since there was nothing in Juneau, they felt they would like to have something that would commemorate that for Juneau.
And so aside from the physical chair that you said is in Capitol Park, is that correct?
That's right. It's Capitol Park.
You have an exhibit explaining everything you just spoke about.
Yes. The exhibit is at the City Museum.
And when does that run until?
That will run until October 25th.
Okay. Sounds fascinating. And aside from the sort of personal connection you had in that you were 1 year after, you're the class of 43.
Right.
What got you into history, Marie? You seem very interested in history, and we're going to talk about the historical walks. What hooked you?
Well, let's say I'm a third-generation Junoite. My grandparents came here in 1894. My grandfather came to work in the mines, as many of the families who came did. And so I have been involved with history all my life and am to this day, more like we'll be to the day I die. So,
you sound passionate about it, like you enjoy it.
Well, I do. I do, yes.
And if somebody wanted to meet you or get a perspective from you on history in Juneau, they could take a historical walk with you. Is that correct?
Well, they could, because the historical walks that we do, and these have been, we can't remember just when we started it, but it's been at least 6 or 7 years that they have been going on. We do them 3 days a week. And they run about an hour and a half. We've kind of changed it over the years. We started out with the idea that it would be nice to have just a walk that would talk about the history of Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
And started out actually going downtown and round through town because there's a lot of history down there. But for the summer here, which is when we do it, we had to fight with the tourists, let's say, trying to find a spot where you could have 6 or 7 people, you know, together to talk about this, that, or something else.
Sure.
And even to get through the streets, it just got to be too much of a problem, let's say, at times. So we decided, all right, one of our other people, Joel, who does one of the other walks, said he decided to try going over to the state office building, which is right across the street from the museum, of course, and that you could talk about the history of Juneau from either side of the state office building because there are patios out on both sides.
Right.
And so from there, we could cover most of the history of Juneau.
And not have to walk that far.
And not have to walk that far. Except that then you had to kind of drop out some of the downtown type of history. But we still try to include it in there. But you can do that. You can pretty well do that from everything that you can see from both sides of the state office building. You can give almost a total history of Juneau. And that starts with, you know, when did we have electricity? 1893. When did we get telephones? 1893. Those kinds of things that tells you how Juneau grew.
When I know there are a few more walks this season. From when to when and how does one get involved?
So the walking tours are Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 1:30 p.m. and they cost $25 and that includes admission to the museum. What you get in that is, as Marie said, an hour and a half walk. We also go down 4th Street to Gold, up to 5th, and then come back down 5th and end at the Capital Inn B&B, which is a historic home. And Linda, one of the owners, is a fabulous baker and prepares some snacks and coffee and tea and refreshments for the visitors at the end of the tour. And so those will run until September 24th.
Okay. So for $25, you could go see the empty chair exhibit. Probably going to see...
Well, we stop right where it is. And if we have time, sometimes we run out of time, we can go up to it, right, because it's right at the Capitol Park, which is on our route, really. And what we do is we try to connect the buildings as we're going across on 4th, mm-hmm. and then up and across on 5th, which is the school street kind of. 4th Avenue is kind of the churches and the big buildings, but we can relate the buildings to the people and when they were built and why and all of those kinds of things to try and connect as much history as you can in just going a couple blocks, you know.
It's really amazing how much history there is in so few blocks.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like fun. And tomorrow the weather's supposed to be nice. I might have to come see you.
It is supposed to be lovely. And Marie will be leading it tomorrow.
Well, that's great. Marie, is there anything in particular that you really like to talk about? Is there a favorite story of yours that you could share with us to take us out? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Well, we have two people we talk about, which are kind of embedded in journalist history. As I said, we can cover most everything from the state office building, one side or the other. That's everything from transportation to, you know, what happened when. And then we go where, because this summer there's been so much noise around the Capitol building, mm-hmm. which we used to go across on 4th because you could talk about the Capitol building and all the buildings along there. But it's easier now to go down 3rd, talk about the Barron's Bank and the Barron's family there. And we try to connect as many of the old-time families as we can into the stories.
Okay.
You know, the businessman and the different apartment houses, the Russian church, all of those things that to kind of try and tie it all together. But two people that we do talk about, one is China Joe, who had a bakery on the corner of 3rd and Main and did not get shipped out of Juneau when they shipped all the other Chinese miners out. That was in 1886. And so he stayed because he had a history with all the miners in Juneau, really. And then the other one is our more scandalous figure, actually, who was the Birdman of Alcatraz, which many people have heard about, seen the movie, which was supposed to be in Alcatraz, but it actually, all his work was done in Leavenworth. But he spent his whole life in jail because of the fact that he shot somebody here. And so that's two stories that kind of go along with everything else as far as the history of Juneau.
It sounds like fun. Christina Bruce, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Marie Darlin, thank you. Tours Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1:30, leaving from the City Museum. They're $25. Does somebody need to call to make a reservation, or can you usually just show up?
You can call, but you can show up about, I would recommend, 10 to 15 minutes early.
Okay.
And, you'll have a lot of fun, I guarantee, and you'll learn a ton. I know I have, just from being involved.
Great. Anything else you'd like to add?
No. Just say it's been a great summer in spite of the rain.
Thanks again, Marie. Thanks, Christina.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 8th of September, 2014. It was on this day in 1504 that Michelangelo unveiled his sculpture, David. The project had been around for a while. It started with a block of marble more than 19 feet high. A sculptor named Duccio had a hand in it, tried to do the feet and the legs, and then another sculptor, Rossellino, tried and also gave up. The marble sat in a courtyard for a while. And then the church settled on awarding the commission to 26-year-old Michelangelo Buonarroti Simon, who was undaunted by it, even though the chunk of marble had the mistakes of the two previous sculptors already carved into it. Started sculpting in the fall of 1501, finished less than 2 years later. Statue was then 17 feet tall, weighed several tons, and it was moved by a complicated system of beams from which it was suspended. It was moved by more than 40 men to where it stands today in the Palazzo della Signoria and unveiled on this day in 1504. It was on this day, 1952, Ernest Hemingway published The Old Man and the Sea. He'd been living in Cuba, working on an epic novel, couldn't quite get it right, decided to publish a small piece of it, just 27,000 words, came out at the end of August in Life magazine, and in September published by Scribner. It was a comeback for Hemingway. His last major work had been For Whom the Bell Tolls 12 years earlier. His book Across the River and Into the Trees, published in 1950, was panned by all the critics who reviewed it. But The Old Man and the Sea changed all of that. Life magazine sold 5 million copies in 2 days, and it was a bestseller in book form, in which he wrote, "The shark swung over, and the old man saw his eye was not alive, and then he swung over once again, wrapping himself in two loops of the rope. The old man knew that he was dead, but the shark would not accept it. Then, on his back, with his tail lashing and his jaws clicking, the shark plowed over the water as a speedboat does. The water was white where his tail beat it, and three-quarters of his body was clear above the water when the rope came taut, shivered, and then snapped. The shark lay quietly for a little while on the surface, and the old man watched him. Then he went down very slowly." A passage in which the old fisherman says, "Man is not made for defeat. A man can be destroyed, but not defeated." Here's a poem for today by Margaret Hasse, "What the Window Washers Did." They arrived in a truck at 8 a.m., introduced themselves as Dave and Mike, said no, they brought their own supplies and equipment, said yes, pay in advance. They circled the house, removing storms, tugging at last year's ivy that cast its spell of thatch across the east windows. I opened the door to Mike, watched as he positioned water bucket and rags. Through grimed glass latticed with cobwebs, Dave appeared on the outdoor side. As if starting a fight, both lifted their Windex bottles at the same time, seemed to squirt each other in the face, the men silent as mimes in a mirror, with big hands tracing one another, rubbed the surfaces of all the panes until the glass squeaked and disappeared. The sun, free to fly in, flung a carpet of light on the floor. A poem by Margaret Hasse, "What the Window Washers Did," from Earth's Appetite, published by Noden Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Juno Arts and Humanities Council is kicking off their 41st season of eclectic, adventurous, frolicking fun. Beginning with the UK Ukulele Orchestra in October and continuing with Kea Aloha, Hawaii's Slam Master and Poet Laureate, the Intergalactic Nemesis, Motown, Body Vox, Metallus M5 Mexican Brass, and Second City. Flex Passes membership and tickets for the season are available at jahc.org or 586-ARTS. Don't miss a truly fantastic season at the Jack.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 8th, 2014. Scott Burton in the studio with you here. Joan Partis will be back on Wednesday. And joining me in the studio is Library Director Robert Barr. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for
Oh, keep doing that. There's your mic. So, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's nice to have you here. So you're the library director. Now, in case we have a new listener out there, mm-hmm. could you start by outlining for me the scope of the library system here in Juneau?
Sure. So we have three public libraries in Juneau, in addition to some other libraries, too. We have, of course, the Egan Library at UAS and the State Library in the State Office Building that will soon be moving into this new awesome building that's being constructed on Willoughby, the SLAM building. And so I'm the library director for the city, though, which is the three public libraries. So downtown Juneau on top of the parking garage, the Douglas Library in the building that's shared with Capital City Fire Rescue over in Douglas, and the Mendenhall Valley Library, which is currently in the Mendenhall Mall, but we will be moving into a new facility in the fall of next year that's currently under construction in Diamond Park.
That must be very exciting.
It's a really exciting project. You know, I was lucky. I got to come on board after almost all of the funding had been secured,
uh-huh.
and so I get to do the fun part of helping with the design.
So where is it at now? I haven't had a chance to see. Have they? What state is it in?
Yeah, so excavation, which is always, I'm told, the risky part of construction in Juneau, because you're never sure if you're going to hit oil or cars or big stumps or anything like that, is done. So, and we didn't have any mishaps there. And the foundation is being poured. In fact, we're probably pouring it today because it's really nice outside.
Okay, so, good deal.
Yeah.
All right. So, library director, before we get, let's shift gears to you a little bit.
Sure.
How did you get into library sciences?
So I was your typical liberal arts undergrad, and I was working in my library, in my undergraduate institution's library in Liberty, Missouri, a small town north of Kansas City, about the same size as Juneau, actually, not that small. And I was getting close to graduation and was thinking about, all right, well, what's next? What am I going to do? Realized late in the game that I really liked what I was doing at the library for my college,
mm-hmm.
and decided to just continue along. And pursued a library degree after that.
And as far as I can tell, you still enjoy it.
I do. You know, libraries are changing really quickly right
mm-hmm.
now, and it's exciting to be in the industry because there's lots of opportunity. You know, you hear in the news, or at least I hear, I might be more sensitive to it than most, but there's lots of issues right now around network neutrality. You know, what are the FCC regulations going
right.
to be in the new internet and the digital divide and and intellectual freedom and censorship challenges are really near and dear and always have been to kind of the philosophy of librarianship.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conversation that we have at a professional level often. And so it's really exciting to be kind of on the national stage, as it were, in some of these big issues that are being talked about.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what Junoites like at their libraries. What are they demanding these days?
Yeah, so we still move a lot of books. You know, there's lots of talk, and libraries certainly are, and Juneau is too, moving into having more and more electronic content. You know, every
mm-hmm.
year our electronic collections grow and expand, and our circulation increases in that area. But still 90%, 95% of the material that moves out of our buildings is print.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that's a little bit unique about Juneau is that typically in public libraries you see a 50-50 split between kids and adult stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's half and half. In Juneau, we are more weighted towards adult materials. We're about 70-30. Still lots of kids stuff circs, but we have a heavy readership for adult materials.
Okay. And thinking about different communities, you've probably done some research. Are we readers here in Juneau in general?
We're in the average or
okay.
so. You know, we're not exceptional, but neither are we super low in those statistics. I'd say we're somewhere in the middle. We do a better job in the valley than elsewhere. I'll say that.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We read more out there than we do downtown or in Douglas. So if you're downtown or in Douglas, take that as a challenge.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. I bet some people are.
Yeah.
I think it seems like Junoites like to be extraordinary. And
yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. So what are some of the programming? You guys do a lot more than ebooks and print books. What's some of the other programming you have going on?
We do. So We do a lot of kids programming, a lot of emphasis on early literacy, on getting kids ready to read by the time they enter kindergarten. There are, depending on who you ask, 5 or 6 really important skills that kids need to develop before they can really start reading good paragraphs and chapter books. And so most of our programming, not all, but most of it focuses around children. In the last fiscal year, we had about 15,000, 16,000 people attend one of our programs, and 13 of that were kids programs. It doesn't mean there were 13,000 children, but
sure,
the people that attended those were kids. So lots and lots of story times, lots of outreach to the schools, class visits, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we just had one of your colleagues, Beth Weigel, on last week telling us about some of her programs as well. Sounded like a lot of fun. Yeah. And what about just the space itself? Why is that important to a community?
Well, it's nice, I think critical, in fact, for a community to have a civic space where it can gather in and have meetings of public interest and gather to talk about things that that are either of interest to you know, us individually, personally, or that are important conversations to have for our community to grow.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that that I love about libraries is that people, I find, particularly if we're doing our jobs well, when people come to a meeting at the library, they don't necessarily come with a preconceived notion about what that meeting is going to be about and what position we're going to take about it, because it's our job in our meeting room spaces to not, you know, we value neutrality and objectivity quite a bit. You know, this comes through in our collection development. When we're purchasing materials or buying books, it's our objective to collect for the entire community and not just subsets of it or individual perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
And that same mentality of intellectual freedom comes through in our meetings, meeting room policies, and in how we allow the meeting room spaces to be used in the library. And that perspective of, you know, if we need to have a community dialogue about a potentially controversial or divisive topic, the library is a great place to have that, because we do bring that perspective of objectivity and neutrality to the table.
All right, great. And I'm thinking about some of the rooms at some of the different libraries.
Mm-hmm.
There's the meeting space there in Douglas. It's also a neat sort of integration with the fire department, it seems like.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Valley's going to look like. I'm looking forward to that. The
Valley's going to have a lot of meeting room space. When we were doing our analysis of what the Valley Library needed to have, meeting room space was big. There's not a whole lot of that out in the Valley right now that's publicly accessible. And so there will be a really substantial meeting room space. And we actually kind of modeled it off the Douglas space. One of the advantages there is that meeting room is connected, but also separate from the rest of the facility.
Right,
you know, it can
be
open all by itself if it needs to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. What about research? If somebody wants to come in and do research, how would you advise them to begin?
Yeah, that's a little known service that we provide. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is that if someone comes in and they want to pursue a topic, an area of research, we'll do our best to guide them along a good path, a path that that respects, you know, their level of information literacy, and one that is going to enable them, we hope, to be fruitful and successful. You know, reference, providing answers to people's reference questions, but also leading them on the path to good research opportunities is something that we do. We've got about 60 databases that people can't access in any other way than through the library system. And so there's a wealth of really good peer-reviewed content out there that we can connect people with, that all you need to have is a library card for, that you can't just get by Googling it.
Sure. So. Well, an amazing resource that we have here in the community. Three of them, well, two, well, uh-huh. Several, you know, Juno and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
If nuts and bolts wise, if somebody wanted to learn more, I know you guys get your website. Is it?
We do. It's juno.org/library.
Okay.
Really easy. We get about 1 million page views of a year there, so lots of access, lots of information there. You can get to our catalog there. We own about, somewhere in the vicinity of 180,000 items here locally, And we're partnered with Anchorage area libraries and a couple of other libraries around the state. It broadens our community's access to about 2 million items. But kind of going back to that research perspective, if we ever don't have something that someone wants, we have reciprocal agreements with almost all of the libraries in the U.S. and many throughout the world that we can pretty much get whatever,
just
whatever
about
someone
anything.
Wants. Yeah.
Just about anything.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Library Director Robert Barr, anything we're missing? Anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, what else can I tell you? There's an exciting program coming up on September 17th.
Yeah.
So the library is one of the participants in Juno Votes, which is a collaborative community project to increase the turnout of the vote. We only had 19% of our population vote in our last municipal
election. We need to read
and
vote more, don't we?
Yes, reading and voting. That's what we're all about. But that's on, we're having a candidates forum. It's a partnership between Juno Votes, K2 actually, and the Juno Empire on the 17th at the Egan Library in their lecture space at noon. It'll be a lunchtime one. And that'll be an opportunity for people to meet and hear what our local assembly candidates think in their positions in the upcoming election. And then if people can't get to that one, there's another one later in the month. And I am 90% certain that's on September 30th in the evening in the assembly chambers. So one lunchtime one in the valley, one evening one downtown.
All right, Robert Barr, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Scott. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, September 8th, 2014. Tomorrow, on a Juno afternoon, Ken Fix hosts Mark Whitman will be here to tell us about a free movie called Hearts of the Dulcimer. It'll be on Thursday, September 11th. Folks from Mudrooms will be here to tell us about their event on Wednesday night. And the Juno School District's food service manager, Adrian Schwartz, will be here to tell us about the new food service company that's providing school breakfasts and lunches this year, plus Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Tuesday at 3 right here on KTOO News. The weather is absolutely beautiful outside right now, as you can probably see. It's going to stay clear through tonight, and then looks like increasing clouds tomorrow, Tuesday. Highs around 62. Light winds out of the northeast, 10 to 15 miles per hour. And Wednesday, cloudy. Looks like a chance of rain on Wednesday, highs around 59. And Thursday through Friday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, highs around 57. And going into the weekend, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, highs around 57. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.